Poetry can sometimes reveal things to the reader that the poet doesn't see. That happened to Patricia Smith with her 8th collection, Incendiary Art, that intertwines recent traumatic events with the past.
It's funny, when my publisher started to put out promotional material for the book, she said that the core of the book were the Emmett Till poems, and I didn't look at it that way.
Find out how she came to recognize that photos of the body of Emmett Till, the Chicago boy who was brutally murdered in Mississippi in 1955, the year Patricia Smith was born in his hometown, not only galvanized Martin Luther King Jr. in the civil rights movement, but reverberated throughout her childhood and into her book, Incendiary Art, winner of the 2018 NAACP Image Award. You'll also discover what moved this 4-time National Poetry Slam champion from the stage to the page, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with the poet who now lives in New Jersey just after she also won the coveted 2018 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award and was visiting Kansas City as part of Rutgers University's Midwest Poets series. Here's Patricia Smith on what prompted her to put together this book of poems, Incendiary Art.
Emmett Till, although it reaches back in history, it's never quite history for me. I was talking to someone about this recently. The picture of Emmett Till in his open casket was torn out of Jet magazine and kept in our household when I was growing up, and kept in a number of households. My mother and father had come up from the South and settled in Chicago. It was an alien environment for both of them.
I mean, because one was from Arkansas and one
was
from Alabama.
I think it was more of a North-South thing where they felt that they had a handle on how people raised children in the South. But the North had a lot of new rules. This happened with a lot of northern cities. People who had come up from the South had been funneled into certain areas of these big cities, when some of which later became some of the country's biggest ghettos, including the place where I lived. So not knowing what the boundaries were or what the difference was in raising a child in the North, my mother in particular just went all the way in the other direction. So her way of introducing me to the world was to keep me away from it. And I've asked a lot of people my age, and that sheet torn from Jet magazine was pretty much in every household. This was used as a warning: if you overstep wherever the line is, this could happen to you, even though we're not in the South. So in terms of my mother, it was behave yourself around white folks, or this could happen. Which, when you think about it, is a very frightening, you know, and that was it. There was no other material, nothing else. You know, it was just, this could happen to you. And I could ask, well, what happened to him? And they'd say, you don't need to know all that. You just need to know that this could, you know. Recently, teachers talk about the kids who have built layers upon themselves, or their parents have tried to toughen them up so that they don't seem vulnerable. And in a way, it was kind of the same thing. And those poems came about, I found one detail about Emmett's mother, Mamie Till, that her original intent was to travel to Nebraska with him and not to let him go south without her. And it got me thinking about chance. Like, if you turn one way and not another way, if you go to Mississippi instead of Nebraska, if the casket is opened or closed, you know, that would have been a different take on the story. And so it was in my head, and then I remembered wondering aloud about the Choose Your Own Adventure books, which were all about chance. You know, you turn to this page, you get this ending. You turn to that page, you get that ending. And so even before I had fully come up with the premise for the book, I knew I wanted to write those poems, which didn't necessarily have to go in this book. But I think the overall spark for the book was to listen for the voices that you're not hearing. I tell my students that all the time, and I think with pretty much all of those poems, you know, we didn't hear this alternate Emmett voice because his story is so ingrained the way it is. And we don't think, well, this could have happened or this could have happened. It's like,
that was supposed to happen exactly the way it did because it taught us this and we carry it with us and blah, blah, blah. You know, but it's still very present for me.
Well, let's have you read the first of the Emmett Till poems. They're interwoven throughout. Emmett Till, Choose Your Own Adventure.
Mamie Till had hoped to take her son Emmett on a vacation to visit relatives in Nebraska. Instead, he begged her to let him visit his cousins in Mississippi. Turn to page 14 if Emmett travels to Nebraska instead of Mississippi. Incessantly, his mother quotes her God while wrestling with the Plymouth's snarl and clunk. The country's hellish breath, its dank facade, conspire to make him blue and snappish, drunk with dozing. Windows blur with foliage and sweep. At roadside stops, the poison-eyed and devilish slurp their tepid cokes and gauge his spine. Pretending he's preoccupied with being from a place they can't decode and knowing what they don't, he steals his back against their hawk and spittle till the road and Mamie call. To swagger past the pack, he's learned to turn their threats to anecdote and chuckle at the squeeze that begs for throat.
That's the first of many poems about Emmett Till included in the book Incendiary Art by Patricia Smith, who's here with me today for New Letters on the Air. I love the fact that it says, go to page 14, and then I look down at the pages, and it was page 14.
Oh, there was a lot of back and forth on that. And I say, well, it has to be on the page that you land on, even though the instructions are on the same page. Or they wanted to just put them throughout the book and not have the pages matter. But my sense of order just went haywire when they said that.
So. I bet. But I kind of like that because it was like, wait a minute. No, it couldn't turn out that way. Well, it's fascinating to hear about how you conceived of this. And I had no idea, actually, that people tore out pictures and kept them around, because that could be horrifying as
some
a child,
people
for
kept
a child.
It like the same way that we put things on the refrigerator. Some people taped it to someplace in the house. A shadow box, the mirror shadow box with the little porcelain things on it, it could be up there. Sometimes it was folded in a drawer, and when you acted up or needed to be warned again, they would take it. I did a whole talk about this once. Imagine that hanging over your head all the time. The threat of that kind of violence and not being clear on where it could come from. It would be easier to say, oh, if I lived in the South, that's the kind of thing that could happen to me. But then our parents were saying, guess what? That followed us up here. And you still can't trust everyone. So make sure you speak right. Make sure you walk right. Make sure you dress right. Make sure you're beholding all the time. And so it was hard to learn where our own voices were. It was like rehearsing a play. Everywhere you went, you had to look at the other characters and say, am I speaking to the right one in the right way? My mother, when she came from the South, was very ashamed of being from the South. So she didn't talk to me a lot about what she was like as a kid or her lineage or where she lived and all that. So she's still very clipped in that way. So I had to piece together a lot of my own history. And that loomed so large when I was a child, partially because I understood it but didn't understand it. It's like, well, that was down there where my mother didn't want to talk about. And I said, well, if we're not down there, why do we still have to worry about things like that happening? So it was very confusing. It was kind of nightmarish. You know, you'd stare at the picture. And it reminds me in a way of my mother. And it's a lot of mothers, a lot of parents. Television winds up being a babysitter. So she just plopped me down in front of the television. And at the time, there was a lot of feed from the Vietnam War. And no one ever said, no, this is what's happening. This is what started this war. This is what, it's just boom. And at that time, there would be this kind of live feed. And you'd be right in the middle of these battles. And there would be a crawler basically saying, how many dead? And the number kept changing. And changing and changing. And that, I figured, was a warning against something, but no one ever really told me what it was. You know, so the book before this one, Jimmy Savannah, had a lot to do with being first generation up north and that idea about being left to raise yourself because your parents were so confounded about where they were and spent almost all their lives trying to figure out this set of shifting rules for being there. And it's like, okay, you watch television, and we'll come in with this dire warning every once in a while. My mother would say, be thankful for everything white people give you. And my father would say, is she crazy? You know, so I was being buffeted about the whole time. So
yeah, because since your parents were part of the Great Migration, they're almost like immigrants in a way, because they don't have their family. You know, you don't have this extended family around. And I know that a lot of people, when they would move up north like that, during the summers, they would send their kids back to the grandparents.
Sure, and that was another thing. I realized that that was such a normal thing for parents to do. And the way they saw it, or most of them saw it, was getting the child out of the city for a while so they can run and play and be free. And then the Emmett Till incident made the world seem so much smaller. You know, like we were in this neighborhood that we were kind of afraid or warned not to leave. And then the South wasn't available to us in the same way. So the whole book, to me, is, okay, the voices you're not hearing, but I wanted to make sure that there was, even with trauma, there's a lineage, and I wanted to make sure that lineage was clear, because it could have been just a book that was all set.
You mean lineage?
In the presence.
And that, that our history plays into
right,
our present.
History plays into where we are now,
right,
what we're afraid of, what we're not afraid of. I mean, I had to go to Mississippi for a funeral recently, and my mother, and she thought I was driving into 1950 Mississippi. You know, I told her I was renting a car, and she was like, oh, my God. And I said, yes. And she said, well, those highways, you know, and I'm like, well, at least we can all use the same restroom now, you know. But when she left it behind, it's kind of frozen in time for her.
Sure.
You know, and so the idea of me just driving around South just horrified her. A lot of us, the things that haunt us, you could pretty much just turn around and point to where they had their beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, African Americans have a very public history. To this day, you can see the roots of some of the trauma in the prison industrial complex and the shootings that are happening, you know, oftentimes at the hands of the people who are supposed to be protecting us. They don't come from nowhere, you know, and both sides of the story are very aware of the history that precedes it and are both kind of taking their own stance on both sides of it. So a couple of things in Incendiary are kind of leading me toward the next project. In Incendiary, there's a very long segment about the mothers of some of the people who've been murdered. And so I'm starting to write a book of short stories. Each story is going to be one of those mothers.
Oh, that's a good idea.
There's so many different, like Trayvon Martin's mother, who is middle class, basically. And then there are mothers who are decidedly not middle class, and the different ways that they find out. And so there's going to be a series of stories with the knock on the door or the doorbell, how each woman receives it. And then there's going to be stories which sound really plain, but about how do they fold themselves back into their lives? How do you do a thing like go back to church or go to a beauty salon or go to the laundromat? Because in some instances, you've seen loss where they fly in psychologists and they say, oh, that poor woman. And that doesn't happen. And many times, the woman has to resume her life blocks away from where they lost their child with no help. So how does that happen? How does the community help if they do? Where does the woman get that strength from? So a lot of those incidences in Incendiary are in my head just got wider and wider and wider, and I want to spend more time with those women.
I've got one of these incidents marked in here,
mm-hmm.
and I thought I might get you to read that and then talk a little bit about how you repeat the last line for several pages in a row.
Oh, sure.
And this is from Incendiary Art by Patricia Smith.
September 14, 2013, Bradfield Farms, North Carolina. After being involved in a traffic accident, Jonathan Farrell, 24, knocked on the door of a nearby house for help. The woman inside called the police. They arrived and shot him 10 times. My son said, I just had an accident. I need to use a phone. She said, you're black. My son said, it'll only take a minute. I need to call the police. She heard, call the police. My son said, I know it's late, but I just had an accident. She said, 911. He said, okay then, you'll call 911? She said, you're black. The police said, is he black? She said, he's black. When the gun arrived, it said, I just had an accident. The gun 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 said, I just had an accident.
That's from Incendiary Art by Patricia Smith. And this is New Letters on the Air. Visually, that line is on a page, on another page, on another page, on another page. And it had a lot of power visually. That was a good idea because you know this pattern is repeating because we've just gone through all these incidents mm-hmm. that aren't the same but have the same sort of fear.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to use incidences that weren't household names. I don't want people to think that you hear about Michael Brown and you hear about Trayvon Martin and it's happening, but it's not happening that much. It's like a steady drumbeat in the community. And maybe you'll hear about it if there's an audio tape or a videotape, but there's several that you don't hear anything about. And I wanted to use those so you can get the idea that it's not something that we can just say, oh, thank God that's over, because it's never really over.
It's like the mass shootings.
Right.
I mean, they don't seem to ever be over
right.
either. So.
And in terms of that, the line, I just had an accident, is in a poem almost immediately preceding that one. And I think when I first wrote it, all of those I just had an accident were on the same page. And maybe about the fifth one I would have to turn. And then I realized I want the listeners and the readers to hear and see 10 gunshots, to see what do you have to do? How much time passes? How much do you have to kill one person? If you're a policeman and you're trained and the person has already been hurt in a car accident and can't run, one well-timed shot, if you had to shoot him, he'd be gone. You don't have to shoot anyone 10 times. So I want the repetition, and I want people to see how long 10 times really is, and to imagine each one of those bullets going into his body. You know, I'm constantly telling my students that they have a lot of power on the page, that you can make a reader feel what your intention is by how you place lines on the page. If you want them breathless, you place the lines close together and you use very little punctuation. If you want them to have time to muse and to feel each line, you put as much space between them as you can. And I wasn't sure my publisher was going to go for that. And I told her how important it was in setting the pace of the book and getting that point across, not only for that one poem, but for the poems that were immediately surrounding it.
I think it worked. And so did a lot of other people, because it won the 2018 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award and the NAACP Image Award.
Who would have thunk it, huh?
Congratulations.
The Kingsley is funny because it's such a out there award. Like, I know the woman who won it last time. And it's funny how you write yourself off of things and go, wow, that would be really great. But
yeah, because it's a big monetary award besides being prestigious. Isn't it $50,000 or something? Is it $100,000?
It's $100,000.
$100,000.
It's the biggest award for a single poetry book.
Yeah.
And so trying to make that make sense in my head, like, are you kidding me? And I'd almost not written the book off, but Jimmy Savannah had gotten a lot of attention. I was happy with that. Incendiary Art, when I finished it, I remember my husband and I have adjoining offices. And when I thought, I said, okay, that's it. And I thought, this book is way too dark. You know, when you're putting a poetry book together, you balance the funny poems and the not so funny and the long ones, the short ones, and the form. And I said, there's no way for light to get into this book. And the first few readers I had, they said to me, this is a really difficult read. Like, I couldn't read it in one sitting. I had to stop and come back. So I thought, I really wanted to write the book. I was happy it was out there. I thought maybe it was heavier than most people had space for.
You know, it came out at the right time, too, because we're in a space right now of looking at very heavy things. So
well,
I think the timing for this book was
timing was good and bad. And unfortunately, when it came out, it seemed to be at the right time. And then the regime in Washington changed. And there was so much so soon with things coming, you know, and those stories, that issue, it was getting down on the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got too much else to worry about, you know. And that was very frightening to me that people had just kind of started to pay attention.
To Black
Lives
Matter.
And then we get someone who's like, no, this is not even a thing,
yeah.
You know. And now, unfortunately, it comes around again. I mean, there's no period at the end of the last line in that book. I could have kept going
mm-hmm.
for longer than I care to talk about. You know, I have a poem about Philando Castile, you know, shot in Minneapolis, filmed with his girlfriend, with his child in the back, in a car seat. I have a poem about him that could have easily have gone in there. I have a poem about Stephon Clark now. You can't kill a man in his backyard and then try to make it make sense.
And talk about a lot of gunshots on
yeah.
that one. I mean, just yeah. absurd.
And so now we have another couple of visual, high-profile cases. Part of me is pressed to think, I need to keep writing this book, but I can't. Someone else will do it. Someone else will take this up. The story will change somehow. Maybe they'll find a way to let some light in and turn towards solutions somehow. That's a problem, I think. You feel so close to the topic and you just want to ride it out, you know, and say, I have to keep going. But you have to trust that the community of writers, somebody's going to pick it up.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, you've been dealing with this subject matter for years and years and years because I know one of your early books from 1993, Close to Death,
mm-hmm.
had a lot in it then. And when you think about that, it's a little disheartening. You know?
Well, yeah, that yeah. you could have books in entirely
decades
different eras.
Of books, yeah.
yeah. It's funny, I hadn't thought about a connection between those two books. And I think part of it was I've learned so much more about writing. I was such an undisciplined writer. I think I could look at those poems and go, oh, I should have approached this way and written this way, and it could be a third of its length. What poets do, we take huge, unwieldy stories and put them in tight control spaces. And the more story you could get in the tighter space, the more impact that story is going to have. And when I did Close to Death, I didn't know that. It was very soon after spending a lot of time in Poetry Slam, and I got introduced to poetry by getting up on stage and doing it. So the discipline that a real poet needs was slow in coming. And that was when I was beginning to realize that I needed it, but I wasn't quite sure how I was going to get it.
Speaking of poetry slams, I'm glad you brought that up because I think you're a 4-time National Poetry Slam champion or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I wish people could see you at that moment. But
whatever that means. Yeah, I am.
Can you tell me the point where it became really important for you to start reworking it for the page in the way that you were just talking about?
I don't know if I could pin it down to a moment. You have to know a little bit about the environment then. It was all of a sudden these audiences are coming out to see these people, and the so-called academic poets, for want of a better term, were suspicious, like, where'd these people come from? So they said, oh, we'll just label that performance and button pushing and they'll be gone soon. And we would look at them and go, oh, they've got all the grant money. We don't need that. We're the rebels, you know. And then we'd stare at each other like we weren't all using language, you know. And that mistrust wasted a lot of time. And there was a little bit of crossover. Here's my moment. Reginald Gibbons, who used to edit Tri-Quarterly magazine, big wig, and I did a reading together in Chicago. They used to use this for, like, entertainment. They come on first and warm the crowd up, and here comes the big important one. And I had done enough research at that point. I was so nervous about reading with him because I'd heard the, oh, what we do is just performance, and you don't want to believe it, but somewhere in your head you go, what if it's just, you know? So I read, he reads, and I'm still kind of like, he's not saying anything. I'm just kind of like, oh. And he said, can I see that one poem that you read? And I said, oh, this is it. I'm going to give it to him. He'll see. There's no line breaks. All I cared about was getting the poem down on the page. It looked like a big block of prose. And he's going to say, yes, I was right. See, you know. And he looked at it, and he gave it back to me. And he said, could you put your name and address on here? And I said, why? He says, I'm going to send you a contract. I want to publish it. And granted, we would work on how it looked on the page and all that. And I said, I'm cutting myself off from a whole part of the canon. I'm not responsible for them cutting us off, but I'd be a fool to do this because all that I could learn from this, I'm not learning. And then when I decided to get my MFA and I studied form and prosody exclusively, I did it because all while I was editing for the stage, I was editing for sound. And if you're editing for sound, you're already writing in meter. You just don't have a name for it. And once I realized that, the two things went, and I realized there was not a performance poetry and a page poetry, that there was well-crafted poetry. And if it's well-crafted, it can go wherever you need it to go. You don't have to change it for the stage or change it for the page. And a lot of stuff that I had been performing, you have this conversational tone on stage, and there's a lot that you have to say because the listener can only hear the poem once, and then they're gone. They can't take it home. And so a lot of that kind of throat clearing and stuff like that, I had to get rid of. And it was a real joy of mine to revisit a lot of those kind of talky pieces and go, oh, okay, there is a poem in the center of this, you know. So I realized that I wasn't a performance poet. I was a poet who started out in performance, but that there was someplace else to go. And granted, there are still people who started with me who are still doing that thing and getting on Greyhound and sleeping on people's couches, because I think some people started to really believe the, oh, we're not poets, and so it's easy for them to read to each other instead of branching out and realizing they have something to give the rest of the canon.
Poet Patricia Smith. We heard her read from her book Incendiary Art, the 2018 winner of the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award and the NAACP Image Award. She was in Kansas City that year for Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series. You'll have a chance to hear poetry from the Guggenheim Fellow's earlier book, Should Have Been Jimmy Savannah, and the other half of this interview in an upcoming New Letters on the Air. To make sure you don't miss it, keep up with us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, or Twitter. If you want to hear some of our other programs, visit our website, newletters.org, and click Listen under the New Letters on the Air tab. While you're there, consider making a tax-deductible donation. It would be greatly appreciated. We're a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Ashley Coate, Chloe Syme, Dylan Piles, Danny Reeves, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.